Speaking on what we had published as the third theme, The Residue, A Hunger for Wholeness. Dr. Marty, we look forward.
Before the cameras roll, I should explain why the speakers wear ties. I find that's really offensive to a lot of people here at Holden, I've learned. And the reason is very simple. They want us to hide the microphone. So we'll join you in the customary informality every time except our time up here. I don't know whether the cameras are rolling or not for this, but I imagine Father McBrien would like it if they would be, because I'm going to give a commercial for his book before I have my address tonight. First, I'll explain why, and then I'll do it. Yesterday morning, I congratulated Walt Pilgrim for the fine staff of speakers he'd brought together this year, saying that he really was ahead of the game because he had the hottest number in Catholicism, the new chairman of the department at Notre Dame and author of the big book in Catholicism, perhaps for the 80s, and I thought that was quite a coup. And then he said, well, you suggested him. and I had a short memory. I didn't remember I had done that. I had been on a program with him. I've read, I think, all his books and been most impressed by one called Do We Need the Church? It's influenced me, and it will show up in the fourth lecture this week. And during the time when Pope John Paul II was in America, many of you who watched the morning CBS program have seen him interviewed, and it seemed to me he had that kind of expression that I admired. But I didn't want to own up to it because I didn't know if he's any good or not in this setting. So I was really embarrassed this morning when, before he was introduced and before we found out that he didn't bomb, I was among those who were credited with helping bring him here. Well, the reason I was sort of ducking this was, on the way up, Walt came in with kind of a concerned look. It was in the bus during the first 10 turns. And he said, Father McBrien's knuckles are like this, and the white is showing through the skin, and I don't like to see strong men cry. He's looking out the window. Could you distract him? So I stood in the aisle and visited a while so he wouldn't look down. And we learned gradually that he's really a Boston boy, grown into Boston manhood. And when they told him South Bend, he felt a lot like the early explorers who thought you're going to drop off the world when you got a certain point. And to hear of the state of Washington and these heights and primitive condition, his idea of health food is a steak with the fat trimmed off. So I feel that since he's going through all that suffering for us, I should compensate now by saying something about his book. I find that easy to do. I read this book in galleys. The publishers down the block from Augsburg in Minneapolis, Winston, a fairly new firm, and it put out as attractive a duo volume as I've ever seen. I like books. I used to like books even if they just felt good. I brought one book home. The boy said, "That's Dad's best smeller." The goo. But I want to say now, what you heard this morning really was an expansion of but three out of some 1,300 pages here, those theses. Three pages out of some 1,300. It's that kind of richness. And as I read it from an Augustanan point of view, there are some pages, some elements on scripture and tradition, some such things that would be different, but I really believe that easily 9/10 of it could be used in adult courses in Lutheran, Episcopal, United Church of Christ, and elsewhere. Not only as an eye-opening as to where Roman Catholicism is and what it is, but as an exposition of the evangelical Catholicity that we share. And there are outlines for many courses there. What I like about it is a jargon-free book, and when there's a technical term, it defines it. Seems to me the only way one should go about writing books. And covers so much history, so much Bible, so much theology that I find it very easy to give the plug. And therefore, if he doesn't like it here this week, or you don't like him, at least I'm off the hook now because I've said what I believe deeply about that book. It's going to be around many years. It's $29.95, which sounds like a lot, but per pound it's not bad. Yeah. And it is getting toward the time when various groups in the congregation wonder what to give the minister or the church library or whatever. And I always like to get one book that will make you get rid of 10 others, space being what it is. And this is the kind you don't need 10 other books if you have. That ends the commercial. Dear friends, last evening I began with a text from Colossians on how all things hold together in Christ, as a contrast to the description of modernity in which nothing seems to hold together, in which life was chopped up and differentiated. I want to do the same kind of thing with the text tonight, not commenting on the text, but again to show the clash of worlds which someone who has been caught up in the thrust of biblical language faces as he or she deals with the hungers within and the options around. And this comes from the early part of Ephesians in the second chapter. Remember that you were separated from Christ, alienated from the commonwealth of Israel, strangers to the covenants of promise, having no hope and without God in the world. But now in Christ Jesus, you who once were far off have been brought near in the blood of Christ. For he is our peace, who has made us both one and has broken down the dividing wall of hostility by abolishing in his flesh the law of commandments and ordinances, that he might create in himself one new man in place of the two, so making peace, and might reconcile us both to God in one body through the cross, thereby bringing the hostility to an end. Someone asked John Murray Cudahy, a Fordham sociologist, if he would define modernity in one word, and he tried it. Refinement. Refinement in two senses. And they're the two senses that I was using last night. The first, refinement in the sense that it grinds everything up. Everything scandalous, everything embarrassing, everything that identifies you or whatever gets ground up as if in a great colander or sieve until it all comes out a lot like everything else. Very diffuse and thinned out. Nothing to grab onto. And so philosophies and religions and commercial options tend to have this ground up and diffuse character, nothing to grab onto, nothing retained in the form it came from the past, no signals unjammed or unmixed with other signals. And refinement also means choosing. She has refined tastes, means that she has sharpened a palate by having made many choices. Or refined means mannered, and the modern world calls forth manners from us. Refinement. Cudahy asks what this does to certain other dimensions of our being. Our deepest roots, identities, hopes, dreams, beliefs, behavior patterns. Since he's a sociologist, he doesn't always talk in language like refinement, and so I'll quote one sentence that sets up tonight's theme. Differentiation, he says, slices through ancient primordial ties and identities, leaving in its wake crisis and wholeness hunger. Differentiation, refinement, chopping up, slices through ancient ties, Abraham, Jesus, Poland, black. Primordial ties, the deep roots that have spoken to our need. Our identities, who am I, to whom do I belong, whom can I trust? Of what community am I a part? And in the result of this is crisis and wholeness hunger. I read that passage once to a class of undergraduates at the University of Chicago, victims very much of the process of modernity. And somehow they seized on that phrase and they wanted much more expounding of it. And I began to reach back into the sources to see where it came from. Because as you think about it and as they think about it, it comes very close to a description of many of the things that we thought wouldn't show up this late in the 20th century. In one of his rare misreadings of where the human race is going, but I think a profound misreading, Dietrich Bonhoeffer talks about the anxieties of life and the passions of life as they relate to meaning, to God, to anxiety, as something that in the future would belong only to intellectuals, the neurotically anxious, and secularized Methodists. But after the war, we found again that however much we tried to live on the surface of life, in the deeper strands of all existence, there were these yearnings for ancient primordial ties and identities that are now chopped up. This chopping up is secular and religious. I stressed the religious last night, but I could have talked about the secular. Chopping up fact from value, a great problem for understanding the Bible, because the people weren't writing objectively. Everything they wrote was from a viewpoint. Chopping up work from home, politics from economics, all these were tied together. Now they're chopped up just like church and state, ethnicity and religion, region and religion, and it left us with choice. Choice between all these options, not knowing where to turn. That creates a crisis, and it has meant that for many moderns, they undertake a search for wholeness that is a kind of an unsatisfying shopping trip. Some people hold these different choices that they make as a set of layers of life. They remember being baptized Catholic, marrying the Jew they met in college, dropping out of both, being into Zen, still liking Buber, now and then marching for Martin Luther King, having had a year of born again and a phase through the charismatic movement, and never meeting anybody who quite matches their own. They lack identities, they lack ties. For some, it's sequential, being into. In one of my books, I quoted the Mike Royko composite of the young man who has experienced the cutting of ancient ties and has the hunger for wholeness, and now goes on that search for wholeness. Royko remembers him from the Rand Corporation in the 60s, button-down collar, crew cut, going to solve the world's problems with technopolitan utopia. And now he's there presenting columnist Royko with a tract to be born again because this kid is into Jesus. He has long hair and a long beard, looks gentle, looks Jesus-like, and Royko thinks he has a vision of peace on his face and he's ready to congratulate him, but he says, you know, you tell me I met you there, but you kind of look familiar beyond that. I think I've seen you with a beard before. And the young man said, yes, I was a weatherman in the late 60s, Technopolis didn't work. We didn't solve everything with our think tanks. And so I had joined the Peace Corps. And in the Peace Corps, we thought we'd solve the world's problems, and that didn't work. And so while in India, I took up Hinduism. And I came back to the States, and when I found that nobody wanted to believe that thing, I kept on searching for myself, and I got into hard drugs. And after this, I went through the Unification Church, and dropping out of it because I felt brainwashed. I was deprogrammed by some people who got me into Jesus. And Royko said, well, that's really a wonderful odyssey. It's a nice search you've had. I'm glad you finally found the final answer, the one way of the track. And he said, but then the young man turned for me and said, yes, but still there are days when I think that when I grow up, I'd like to be a cowboy. The composite has enough touch with the lives we see that it strikes us at once with humor and a sense of pathos, because that isn't that different from what we see and know. Who is this person? Attached to whatever comes. Ravenous appetite, we call it hunger. Plenty of people offering options. How to know when to take the Jesus option more serious than the others and make it more durable than all of them. This modern condition, of course, was made possible only with the growth of choice. All through history, people have been searching for wholeness. I argued last night that the biblical texts are the best place to find this. But they operate generally within, say, two options: the Lord of Israel or the Baalim, the Father of Jesus Christ or the principalities and powers of the time around the shaping of the early church. In the Western church for 1700 years, the church or apathy, but not another choice. But in the modern scene, we see again and again how this has happened. In the biographies of great American seekers, Orestes Bronson, born in New England, baptized Congregationalist, converted a revival to Presbyterianism, moves on to Episcopalianism. I think there weren't many options then, there were. Became a Unitarian minister. Dropped out of that, invented his own religion, a new religion of humanity devoted to Jesus. Wrote a book about it, sold one copy. Found that religion didn't work and kept seeking, seeking, seeking. And we have his letters with another great convert of the century, Father Isaac Hecker, the founder of the Paulist order. And eventually Bronson takes his search for wholeness into Roman Catholicism, because there was a symbolization of permanent authority, and yet he remains a seeker within it. The Grimm K sisters, two of my favorites, pioneer abolitionists, Angelina, the first feminist speaker on the road. It's kind of interesting how that got started. She was an abolitionist making speeches about abolition, and they were so mad about that that they didn't notice it was a woman who was making the speeches. It took a little while until she got into other causes before they knew to get mad at that. By that time, she'd spoken all over New England. But the Grimm K sisters, again, born Presbyterian, born Episcopalian, South Carolina, slave-owning family, converted by a Presbyterian minister, looking for wholeness, they think they'll find a gospel of peace with the Quakers, where everyone is accepting of everyone else, and community is rich and warm, and so they join the community of the Quakers in Charleston, made up of two old men who wouldn't talk to each other or to them. They went north and joined the Quakers and were maverick in that community and made religions out of abolition. They were Millerites, Seventh-day Adventists, vegetarians, graham cracker fans, which was part of, that's where it was born. They were in Raritan community, a new utopia, and so on. There was a continuity to the life, in one sense, in the abolition cause, and they are admirable leaders in that. But there was always that search that somewhere, somehow, I will get the one big answer that will solve it all. And now that sequence of options. Hunger for wholeness in their lives, in yours and mine, the people we serve. Well, where does the word come from? Hunger for wholeness, Cudahy gives credit to Peter Gay, historian of the Enlightenment, a modern rationalist, in his book on Weimar culture. Weimar culture was the culture in Germany after Versailles Treaty and before Hitler, the years of the Weimar Republic. A society that was demoralized, crisis-ridden, people had a hunger for wholeness. It was a society full and rich in options like our own. Architecture, the Bauhaus, Gropius, Mies van der Rohe, Dessau. The arts, expressionism, Beckmann. Drama, Bertolt Brecht. Music, Kurt Weill. Drama, all exploding with talent. But a nihilistic tinge, a tea-dancing culture, in which this wholeness hunger was not easily satisfied. And Peter Gay, in describing it, reaches back into German literature to see how, in the modern period, this begins to develop. The great poet Friedrich Hölderlin's Hyperion, relating it to the Germans, but beginning to talk the language that we use in today's spiritual analysis and therapy. It is a hard saying, and yet I say it because it is the truth. I can conceive of no people more dismembered than the Germans. Now, this was quoted because they had been dismembered by the war, which had killed a generation, by a peace that left them no dignity, by the absence of a philosophy, by the shattering of a century of high humanism and Christian thought. You see workmen, but no human beings. Human beings was his word for wholeness. You see thinkers, but no human beings. Priests, but no human beings. Masters and servants, youths and staid people, but no human beings. Part of human beings. And so Hölderlin looks in the Romantic era for a new wholeness of life. In his Empedocles, he says he is a mortal enemy of all one-sided existence. He hates civilization, because civilization meant this refinement and this loss of wholeness. A generation came along that Peter Gay says was full of disinherited youth, cut off from the past, sensing in its incompleteness, its halbheit, its halfness, the good and longing for a whole, harmonious life and humanity. Other philosophers came along, Paul Nathorp, warning against the dangers of an irrationalism that can come with a search for wholeness. Words like primordial ties can be scary words too, blood and soil. You fear, says Nathorp, the dismemberment of your being and all the piecework of human wishing and knowing, and fail to notice that you cannot achieve wholeness if you reject such large and essential parts of that which has been allotted to all mankind. You seek the indivisibility of man's being and yet assent to its being torn apart. Torn apart by choice, by differentiation, by refinement. And there's where I think Bonhoeffer misdiagnosed the human scene near the end of the Second World War, when he didn't foresee another round of this halbheit, this halfness, this sense of dismemberment, which for a little while didn't seem to reach our culture as much as it did the continental cultures after both wars. And some of it seems lost in the frantic rebuilding of prosperous parts of Western Europe, as it was in the affluent growth society of the United States in the 1950s. Yes, people joined the churches as never before. One of the great problems in church life in the 80s is that the senior generation of its leadership came to maturity during the 50s, the only decade in 48 that Europeans have been on American soil in which things worked religiously. We built, we filled, we had a baby boom, we had Sunday school. There was a search, and we don't minimize it. But out of it came very little spiritual literature of depth, very little language of true conversion. The search, I think, had to become visible at a time when the crisis and the wholeness for hunger became apparent partly because of external circumstances. This time it's in America where things don't all work. We were told to have dominion over nature, and nature fought back. We were told that we could run the secular city and the new creation would be metropolis, and the city burned and burned itself. The city, says Rilke, is beguiling to beasts and infants alike. We thought that our learning, a decade after Sputnik, greatest years of building of college and university we've ever had, would lead to a new era of reason and civility, and it ended with deans locked up and files being burned and establishment being condemned and the world unchanged. And we thought that the reform of the church in Vatican II and the corollaries in the Protestant and Orthodox churches would lead to a new era of concord, and all the while there were hungers not being ministered to under the surface, and a repudiation of what many see as nothing but a rational and bureaucratic reorganization of religious life that didn't touch the heart and didn't reach into the hunger for wholeness. And through the 70s, I believe these understandings only grew. Yes, these are obscured, these hungers for wholeness. If you only look at the surface of life, you can situate yourself in the apartments where the young singles live between flight and briefcase and disco and snort. You can go to retirement communities where, as one of them told a United Church of Christ minister when he asked her why none of them cared about church, though they were aged, and why none of them were taking part in life with an Indian community nearby that needed them and that they needed to rejoin the human race. Why are you living? What's left for you? She said, I'm just living to keep the ever-living juices flowing. There are ways in which we can keep ourselves distracted enough. But by now we have seen enough new voting with bodies and hands and hearts. We've seen enough different options. We've heard enough people, and we've looked in our own mirror enough, the mirror of the soul, to know that the crisis is also here and that the infinite varieties of modernity are upon us. How neat it was in 1955, back when I was getting my start, when Will Herberg said, America is a pluralistic society because it has Protestants, Catholics, and Jews. The old Protestant culture was gone. And then we said, a year later with Gerhard Lenski, oh, you missed one. Black Protestant is enough different from white Protestant. And along came the young people and said, and there's over 30 and there are under 30. And the women came along and said, 51% of us aren't reckoned in any of your books. And group after group came along, and denomination after denomination, and new religious groups until the 60s at the end and the 70s throughout became an explosion of new options which produced their own pathos because each set out to minister to the hunger for wholeness by adding one more option to confuse those who are still searching. Peter Berger's word for it is good once you translate it into English. The pluralization of life worlds. And no one translated it better than Berger and Bridget Berger, his wife, in another book title of theirs, The Homeless Mind. The Homeless Mind. We walk down the street, we go on that jet, we are in the company of people who, unlike people this week, do not share any views of ultimate reality, of how a society is put together, of what the social fabric should look like, or whether there should be one. Pluralization of life worlds, that's chopping up and differentiation, and voluntarism, that's choosing. I doubt whether we could take someone from your studies or your doctor's offices or your acquaintances and say, we want to talk to you about your problem with the pluralization of life worlds and hypervoluntarism. I doubt whether many of them would recognize themselves in that. That's a name we're putting on it. But I think if we watch them make their way, we'll see that that's a part of it. And the wholeness hunger has taken on a new characteristic, in part, in our kind of society, because we have what I like to call, following a term of Daniel Bell's about the social order, a sense of spiritual entitlement. Spiritual entitlement. This is Bell's word for the inevitable psychological corollary of a welfare society. He points out that through most of human history, it would never occur to anybody that they were owed a long life. The Hebrew Scriptures has Yahweh promising it to people who live a certain way and enjoy it as a great gift, but that was rare. Don't let the numbers of the beginning of Genesis confuse you about life in ancient days. Jesus died in his 30s, an old man. That's beyond the life expectancy of his day, Alexander the Great or whoever. By the time Calvin wrote the Institutes at age 26 and Melanchthon wrote the first Lutheran systematics about the same age, about the time you finish your internship or MDiv, they wrote the great classics of theology. In the life expectancy of their day, they had 4 or 5 years to go. It's only in our century that people have a sense that we are entitled to 70 and 80. People never had a sense that they were entitled to security in old age, entitled to financial security along the way, to a life with reasonable physical comfort and access to medicine. 1911, the people in our med school say, is the first year where, on the average, you were better off walking into a physician's office than not. Before that time, more cures killed than cured. So it didn't occur to people that they would be better off. It didn't occur to people that by having 11 babies, they would have a family of 13. Cotton Mather and his wife had 13, and one survived to adulthood. But today we have the things that have made possible physical and fiscal entitlements. And who of us wants to criticize those and see them as something other than an expansion of the sovereignty of God and the care of creation? But the spiritual corollary to that is a puzzling one, because we also often act as if we are entitled, the first generation ever, entitled to something that nobody in the Bible ever got: all the answers, complete satisfaction in our search for wholeness. The text I read from Ephesians, the text from Colossians, any number of texts I could read that speak of this wholeness, breaking down of hostility, talk about a having and a hoping. They talk about a reality that is to come that breaks into the world now. But you read the autobiographies left by the psalmist, by David after Absalom, by Job, by Jesus, and you don't find that in the middle of this existence there are these complete answers to everything that would make someone in our world completely satisfied. Towers fall at Siloam, and children are born blind, and not all cripples are healed, and faith doesn't always come, and it's barely visible in the inner circle. But we have this sense of entitlement that is well catered to by people who know that they've got 29 minutes before a station break in which to attract your attention, entertain you, convert you, heal you, and give you material possessions before exacting a few from you. And to spin the book at the airport newsstand again is that kind of suggestion of a complete and immediate satisfaction. And what we are involved with is a generation-long task of trying again to get people to see that in biblical language it is the pilgrimage itself that is the way in which the search is fulfilled. All the way to heaven is heaven, because he said, I am the way, according to one of the great Christian mystics. That the fulfillment in that biblical parable of the vineyard, oh, how one of my members felt cheated. I got to give up things all my life. I got to bring pies to church suppers and sell tickets and run the Girl Scouts around, and somebody else going to have all the fun in life, and the last minute, whoosh, deathbed conversion, and we get the same ticket. Until you reread the parable and find that it is the latecomers that are cheated because of the meaningfulness of the vineyard life, the work in the vineyard. And that's how somehow, in an era of entitlement, people have again begun to find
what measure of wholeness is to be theirs. What I'm going to do in my remaining time tonight is to describe the ways in which this can be ministered to in three cultures in our society. While the word hunger for wholeness comes from Peter Gay and Weimar culture, and I translated it to our own, I wouldn't profess to be any kind of expert on any culture other than North American, in which I have read more widely. And I would like to say now what these options are. Those of us who saw the film this afternoon about the Southern Hemisphere would know that there are drastically different alternatives there. There are new religions of propheticism in Africa. There are new Pentecostalisms in Latin America. There are new theologies of drastic social change and liberation, all of which are sufficiently widespread culturally that they provide options for great numbers of people. But in North America, rich and poor, white and other colors, men and women, tend to fall into certain other families of possibility for them to carry this search. Tomorrow I will discuss the theological attempts to address modernity, but tonight it is the cultural patterns. And I mentioned them last night, again Daniel Bell, describing the one as what he called the evangelical moralistic culture, the second the redemptive traditional culture, and the third the high-intensity mystical culture. They are not neatly divided from each other. They're zones, and you can transgress from one zone to another, and one member of a family can be in another. They are not, though Marxists would like to make them that, simply lines of class division, though more people of one class may be in one than in another. They are not purely aesthetic, though there are aesthetic differences. They are not neatly theological. You can be Catholic, indeed you could be non-Christian, and have these in formal categories, even if they don't always apply to you in the terms that I've here used. Let me also say that within them, as I see it, there are good options and bad options from the viewpoint of biblical norms and human well-being. There are exploiters in each, and there are people for whom the search for wholeness is begun to be satisfied. Let's take them in order. The first is what Bell calls the evangelical moralistic. It's the old-time religion, which in the definition this week is by far the most modern. It's the people who have best caught on to the nature of modernity and are prospering because they have done so. For that majority of you who are Lutheran, you know that one side of your life is in that camp. Even if you're really Lutheran, it's still in that camp. But Lutheran in America means cheek by jowl, lion by lamb, with the Reformed American majority, and we have absorbed more of it than we might know. We're not distanced from it. It's the old American family album. Roman Catholics acquired more than they knew when they came in the 19th century. A former student of mine and now a colleague of Father McBrien's, Jay Dolan, has written a book with the surprising title, Catholic Revivalism. Most Americans thought that people came over, all baptized in Ireland and Poland and Italy and Germany, came over to America, and some of them hung around. It was just the opposite. Yes, they were all baptized, but few were active in Europe. And they were met at the boat by Catholics who understood that the territory didn't cover. You're coming to non-Catholic and alien soil. And your loyalty has to be won, and your identity has to be given. And you build a big church like in the old country in order to do it and to make a statement that you're here and that you love God and that you love each other. And they learned the same language of conversion, the same rhetoric of sensation, as Perry Miller calls it, as the Protestant evangelicals had. And they learned how to set people in community the way John Wesley had learned in the modern world, for he's the first of the modern Christians in these terms. Even Jews have something of it, this sense that one must choose to be a Jew. There are now Jewish conversion agencies, and last year Reform Judaism, under Rabbi Schindler, announced for the first time since 70 of the Common Era, to my knowledge, that Judaism is indeed a missionary religion and must begin by winning its own young, but will go beyond that. And I have a letterhead that sounds very evangelical from Sinai Temple in Chicago. The motto is, Sinai never does things halfway, which is a way of saying they know that KAM Temple is a little bit down the street and they're both out to get the same people. So they both learned a little bit from Charles Darwin and a little bit from Adam Smith about the competitive principle, and that too has gone into the evangelical moralistic culture. But it was born in Protestantism, John Wesley, the demand for the warmed heart, holism in intimate community, intricate, articulated subcommunities, and an impulse then to go out and reform the world and change it. It's born in the First Great Awakening in the United States. It had ties in the Pietism of the continent and in the Calvinism of a George Whitefield, but it's really born on the eastern seacoast here when people saw that you couldn't bring the territory along. There was still a covenant, but now the covenant had to be owned. It didn't any longer pass through the genes. And there'd be a little church in a little town in New England, and one day someone would saddle his ass and ride into the shadow of that church and gather some people and say, "You're not saved. They're all baptized. They're all members. But maybe they're hearing sermons from someone who doesn't have the warmed heart. Maybe they're getting head-stored typical Puritan sermons that say us in the 17th place, in the 19th place, in the third hour, in the 21st place. And you have to be born again. You have to have this experience." And soon there's a second congregational church. And then some look for a different discipline. And so there's a First Baptist and a Second Baptist. In the spiritual translation of the oldest American sayings, "Damn it, there goes the neighborhood." So that by the time an Orestes Bronson grows up in the early 19th century, he has all those options in any little village before he even travels. And so what had once been an owning of the covenant now becomes voluntaristic. You as an individual, have you found your personal redeemer? What Christer Stendahl of Harvard calls, in Harvard language, that Western anthropocentric, egocentric, Augustinian Lutheran soteriologism. Are you saved? Alfred North Whitehead says properly of those people that they were geniuses because they discerned a new set of hungers in the first democratic generation, the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, the beginning of what becomes the American Revolution and the English counterpart to it, the rise of new freedoms, new toleration, new liberty, new choice, freedom for religion, freedom of religion, freedom for choice, freedom of choice. And to the newcomers, to the smoky cities of England and the growing industrial cities of Germany and Belgium and Holland and France and Switzerland, Glaubens Erweckung, Reveil, awakening, revival, renewal. And to the people on the American frontier who needed hope and cut off from ancient primordial ties, these were geniuses. They didn't do everything, Whitehead says. They're the first generation in the Christian clergy since the beginnings, he said. They failed to make an appeal to constructive reason. Paul reasoned. Augustine and Aquinas and Calvin and Luther reasoned. And they made no appeal to reason. They talked only to the heart, and they left a terrible legacy because from then on, you got a new kind of Halbheit in which you had piety by the standards of piety and reason by the standards of secularity. But let's not fault them for what they did, and let's remember that at their greatest, they still had wholeness. Jonathan Edwards, my hero. I think of him much the way John Kennedy thought of Thomas Jefferson, who once had the East Room of the White House filled with a couple dozen Nobel Prize winners and said, "The greatest concentration of brain power in the East Room of the White House since President Jefferson dined here alone." And I think of the same with Jonathan Edwards when the American Academy of Religion gathers. And Edwards said, "The reason and the affections cannot finally be in contradiction, because they are both grounded in that great being, the Creator." And just as the reason needs redemption, so the affections need redemption. And to have had the experience means also the transforming of the other dimensions of life. So there was a wholeness, but it soon parted, and people became specialists, some at religious experience, some at religious intellectuality, some at religious social action. I always tell Methodists that if they ever got all three parts of their program together, they'd be unstoppable. The warmed heart, the rich community, and the world-transforming figure. The bureaucracy in New York knows how to turn out the pronouncements about how to change the world. The local pastors are good at ministering to the heart-seeking Jesus. There are people who know how to form new therapeutic communities in Methodism, but they don't get the three together. But we have models there, at least, and that's why I say the evangelical moralistic culture is not to be dismissed by those who are not wholly at home in it. It has options. But in the course of time, it now is also at a stage where it builds appetites that are hard then to satisfy. Joseph Smith, a good example, reports that in his little town in New York, all the revivalists came to town. I listened to the Presbyterian and I got converted. I listened to the Methodist and got converted. I listened to the Congregationalist and got converted. They were all good men, and they all taught what they thought was the truth, and they all contradicted each other. So I did what Titus in the Bible says you should do. You take it to God in prayer for wisdom. And the angel came to me and said, here's your solution. You asked which one was true, which one was false. They're all false. And it came a new revelation. So there was still one more religion in the sequence. It's the pattern of what comes of this culture along the way, and that's why there's a succession of bumper stickers and a revolving door of conversions and the musical chairs and a fruit basket upset and a recycling of converts, always looking for that next being born again that will give them the wholeness, instead of understanding that with being born again in the scriptural understanding, there is a long pattern now of growth. Until our own generation, the evangelical moralistic culture was held together in churchly, Trelch would say, sectarian terms. You form a new intense group apart from the world. The great new change that evangelicalism in its church life is just beginning to catch on to is that it too has individualized as much as the mainline churches have. Half the people who tell George Gallup that they are Protestant born again are not on the rolls of any church. 4% of those who were converted by the Here's Life campaign were ever found on the rolls of any church. More and more people are privatizing, creating a pluralization of life worlds. And I go to many conventions, and I can't pick out the denominations, but I can pick out the Corrie ten Boom Club and the Pat Boone Group and the Billy Graham Group and the Carl Henry Group and the Keith Miller Group. These are the new denominations, and you're into one or the other. And then the church, in a sense, becomes irrelevant. So serious minds in the evangelical culture are looking at this. And the other thing that they're doing, and excites me very much, is they are asking whether you can have wholeness if you have nothing but an experience. They are criticizing their own apocalypticists, the late great Planet Earth people. One-line review of Hal Lindsey. This man gave up on the world before God did. They're criticizing the people who use that excuse not to undertake the care of the earth. I don't think someone outside that culture is going to be an effective critic or an effective nudger, but there are marvelous resources within. And one side, I would say, of the Lutheran heart is going to find a good deal of company there. But it needs this transformation. Not everyone that saith, Lord, Lord, not everyone that saith, born again. There is a doing of the will that is a big part of the wholeness. George Farrell's great book title out of Luther's theme, Faith Active in Love. And evangelicalism is trying to recover its long past of that kind of activity. So obviously, the hunger for wholeness is being satisfied by great numbers of people who are in that camp. The second of the camps is what Bell calls the redemptive traditional. We are hauling in this fictive person from your counseling, this person afflicted by the problem of the pluralization of life worlds, the homeless mind, and the hypervoluntarism of dizzying choice. And we show them a second set of options. And indeed, again, as I say, there are some taste differences, there are some class differences. Probably this person is turned off by the visuals of an Oral Roberts program, turned off by the distance from the world of the apocalypticism of some evangelicalism. Quite possibly there is a social class difference, a little more middle class. There's probably a different past. Most people in the evangelical moralistic culture were born there, left, and come back. Our latest data suggests, are you surprised, that group in America which has the highest dropout rate are conservative Protestants, teenagers. But they win them back some years later from their childhood programming. And probably most of the people who end up Roman Catholic, active adults with a religious experience, or Lutheran, or Episcopal, or Presbyterian, or Methodist, or any number of others, are people whose wholeness hunger was charted by a telling of the story in churches of that sort.
They're not satisfied by the same kind of instant experience. They're a little less ready to put on a bumper sticker or maybe even to speak up. There's a certain diffidence about the name. Many of them have what I like to see in a great phrase of Karl Rahner's, a sense that you don't only have the exuberant and sunny spirituality, but they have what he called a wintry sort of spirituality that lives at the edge of modern doubt. For most of the people who are in this second culture are those who are highly exposed to the rest of culture. Some of the sociologists have isolated them into the locals versus the cosmopolites. The restless, the mobile, the people who went off to college, who live in the urban high-rise, who've been dislocated again and again, who've been brought up on all the channels and not just the ultra-high-frequency ones, who've in college been encouraged, even if they went to PLU to read Sartre and Camus, as part of their Christian formation. And so all of these things have been open to them, and they are less likely to be satisfied by the norms of evangelical moralistic culture, though some of them will. As I say, this is a zone and not a camp. They have more terms for describing the crisis. They will more likely go to fashionable therapies than to revival meetings. Their hunger will be satisfied perhaps in somewhat different ways. Sometimes by synthetic, in the positive sense of that term, theologies. They can live with evolution. As I heard Pastor Berkey describing his world of how he'd been brought up in the biblical story and had a great shock of evolution, I thought of our children who were brought up Orthodox Lutheran and in our kind of home and surrounded by all these influences, and somewhere in high school they met some Christians who had problems with evolution because they'd had the biblical story. A new generation is here that doesn't have that problem. From the beginning, they are learning what two different stories are about. They're past that crisis, but they have other ahead. They are the people more likely to do what we heard in the papal and Vatican writings of today, to see a positive search for God in the world religions. Not to say, because the council also doesn't say that, that the full truth and wholeness is there apart from Christ, but that God is stirring in that world. A little more ready for natural law. A little more likely to be instinctively ecumenical. Catholic in the sense that all dimensions of their life are supposed to be reached by this faith. Concerned with therapy. They won't go to an Oral Roberts revival for an instant healing, but they will quite likely be in a pattern of long-term holistic health. They will be moderns, but they are busy with what Karl Rahner calls retrieval, selective recovery of tradition, and that's why Bell calls it that. The sense that you can try on a tradition again, cohere to it, live inside it. And so nurture is more the model than conversion. Because of the intensity of our present crisis, the past two decades, that's not been as marketable an option or as visible in the larger society as the evangelical moralistic one. The culture changes, and these come and go. American religion is a game played by innings, and it isn't that inning. For if the evangelical moralistic culture has the trouble or the problem of overprogramming that leads to reaction, the redemptive traditional culture is one which has often led to less commitment. Nominal assent to all the teachings of the church, but less reason to be involved in getting all your signals from it. And so Christ is often lost among the many Christs and the many signals of the world. It has just as many liabilities as the other. But it remains, again, a zone in which that search for wholeness can be carried on with great numbers of resources. The third one takes only a minute or two to mention, statistically far smaller. Some overlappage with the first two groups, what Bell calls the mystical high-intensity people. The hot as opposed to the cool. The really shook up who need a very heavy dose. For whom the evangelical moralistic culture is too much like home. And too boring or whatever. I often have quoted the Bantu saying from Africa, he who never visits thinks mother is the only cook. And these are the people who've been visiting and got tired of home cooking. And they learn all the other lures of the occult and the Eastern and the African and other cultures which it seems to them they can easily acquire to get a high-intensity experience. But also within the Christian tradition, we have those rare figures, the mystics. The sociologists among you can see I'm being very Trelchian tonight. I started with a sect, I moved to the church, and third type was the mystic. Their search for wholeness, satisfying their hunger for wholeness, is grasped in their vision of the divine, of the unum, of the all, of the one, of a perfect harmony with being and of nature, and a union with God at God's level, as it were. As I say, statistically small. People have always been doing it in America ever since modernity hit. Became a movement. Peter Berger once said, a movement is something everybody's always been doing, but as soon as the sons and daughters of professors and mass communicators take it up, it's a movement. And when they began doing it, it became a movement. Astrology, omen, exorcism, the occult, many of them faddish, many of them deep. Some of them moving beyond the mere experience. Charles Peguy, the great French Christian, said, everything begins in mysticism and ends in politics. There's a sense in which you can take that vision and carry it out into a larger social world. Or Dag Hammarskjöld's great line, today the path to holiness necessarily is the path of action. And there are isolated mystics in our society who carry it. I wanted to close with a rather vivid picture of how these three cultures minister to the hunger for wholeness, and to show you that I keep learning wherever I am. I learned from a little walk with Richard McBrien today when he said, are places like this distinctively American Protestant phenomena? What do you mean? Well, Holden Village. He said, Roman Catholics don't have places like this. I thought, lots of luck. That's your problem. We last got something we can advertise that you don't have. And I started thinking, and I came up with some instant answers. In a way, yes. Not just here. Dr. Wolf probably would know the name Eugen Rosenstock Husse, a great German scholar in many fields who felt that in their present form, the academy and the church were not ministering to the wholeness of life, and he invented the modern work camp, which the World Council and the American Veterans and Civilian Conservation Corps undertook. But it was fundamentally, I think originally, an American Protestant fusion of the love of nature that was being lost in the city, a sense of how do we build community, our search for wholeness, how we have religious experience, and the like. And I would picture three different kinds of these places. If you're 16 years old and you go to a Southern Baptist camp like this, as 40,000 do to one I visited in Texas every summer, everything that occurs there is designed for you to come home with the experience of being born again. It is a rite de passage, a rite of passage. You are at that stage of life in which you undergo something that the language is turn your back on the world, but it really sets you in the world. It's the parental world from now on. You join the country club. You soon own Holiday Inn stock and all the rest. It isn't much of a world you leave behind, but you do have the personal appropriation. And I don't consider that an inauthentic experience. You have a personal appropriation. And everything there is designed for that instant act. And you can say, that night it happened, the fourth night of the preaching. Second kind is the Holden Village kind. Second model here again. In which we are to be put back in touch with nature, which most of us urbanites have left behind. Mountain, hill, sky. The music, the song, the story, the pattern of the Eucharist. It's a selective retrieval. We can't go home again. We are ecumenical. We reach into the deeper Catholic traditions for this. But nurture and growth, therapy, mutual acceptance tends to be the pattern. Nobody's embarrassed if you're born again here. But it's not a calculated end of the search. Most of us who come here are to be born again every day in the re-acceptance, renewal, repentance that comes with our baptism. And the third pattern, the high intensity, would be the Esalens, the Holovitas of Ruth Carter Stapleton's, the place where there's a vestige or remembrance of the Christian story, a highly eclectic pattern, and you leave behind most of what you've known before anywhere else for this high experience. It's not mine tonight to judge just what's right. Different strokes for different folks, I suppose, is a very modern understanding of the world, but rather to say that the plumb line now has to be dropped within these communities. We have to seek those norms by which that in each of them, which draws upon biblical resources, is judged by those biblical resources. And by the long term and durable, I believe philosophically deep, and physically and psychologically profound understandings of human well-being will minister best to people who learn some measure of meaning in the search itself, knowing that wholeness is eschatological, the end of the story, the promise, but by the grace of God is shown us in enough grace and vividness that it makes the journey worthwhile. Thank you.